Workers Council of Northern California, I'd like to welcome you to tonight's program, Critical Factors Shaping the Future of Sudan. This event is sponsored by the World Affairs Council and co-sponsored by Human Rights Watch and International Development Exchange. My name is Harold Brooks. I am a member of the Board of Trustees of the World Affairs Council and CEO with the American Red Cross for the Bay Area. And I'm honored to be here as the moderator for this evening's program. The World Affairs Council of Northern California invites you to join us in seeking knowledge, expanding your networks, and discovering innovative solutions to global problems. More information about the organization, as well as a recording of tonight's program, can be found on our website at www.itsyourworld.org. Council programs can also be heard on a weekly one-hour radio show, It's Your World, which airs every Monday evening at 8 p.m. on National Public Radio, KQED 88.5 FM. Tonight's program is being recorded for future broadcasts, and I'd like to thank our engineer, Paul Lancour. Now, before we begin, please take a moment to turn off your cell phones and any other noise-making devices. While you do that, I'd like to take this opportunity to let you know about upcoming events. On Wednesday, January 27th, the Council is pleased to present a special program with the award-winning travel journalist and broadcaster, Don George. This event is entitled Travel in the Age of Obama, 10 Trips for Travel in 2010, and it's going to take place in the Council Auditorium at 7 p.m. Then next week, on Tuesday, February 2nd, the Council welcomes Brian Tucker, President of Geohazards International. In light of the recent earthquake in Haiti, Mr. Tucker will discuss how crises of this magnitude can be prevented in Haiti and elsewhere in the developing world by instituting better building practices and making disaster risk management part of international development efforts. This event will be held here again in the Council Auditorium at 6 p.m. And I can tell you that is going to be so critical to pay attention to the buildings in Haiti pancaked, which means that this concrete, very heavy concrete, just went straight down, and it's a really brutal, awful thing. So the more we can do to focus people on proper construction, the better we'll be. I'd like you to encourage you to take advantage of the blue cards that are in your seats. Please write legibly so that I can read them, and hand your question cards into council staff. Audience questions will be posed to our speakers during the second half of our program. Now it's my honor to introduce a distinguished guest. As many of you well know, Sudan is facing critical moment, particularly relating to human rights, national elections, and the U.S.-Sudan policy. So we're really fortunate to have three speakers with distinct backgrounds. Our first speaker this evening is going to be Tshege Kasambala, Senior Researcher in the Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. Ms. Kasambala has an extensive experience in human rights and international justice issues in Africa, including Zimbabwe, Southern Africa, where she's also worked with Amnesty International. Ms. Kasambala joins us this evening to discuss human rights abuses in Sudan on the case of indicting President Omar al-Bashir. Our second speaker this evening is the Honorable Ezekiel Lol Gotkoff. Mr. Gotkoff is head of mission for the government of Southern Sudan to the United States. He is also former Sudan People's Liberation Movement representative to the United States. Mr. Gotkoff joins us to discuss the political climate in Sudan, particularly given the upcoming elections in April of 2011, a referendum in Southern Sudan. Our third speaker this evening is Roger Winter. Mr. Winter has worked on a number of issues in Sudan, including as executive director of the nonprofit U.S. Committee for Refugees, then as assistant administrator for USAID, and later as deputy secretary of state's special representative on Sudan from 2001 to 2006. Mr. Winter continues to advise the government of Southern Sudan and joins us to discuss U.S. policy towards Sudan and what has changed under the Obama administration. Each of our speakers is going to spend roughly 10 minutes to speak, and then we'll take written questions from the audience. So please join me first in welcoming Ms. Katambala.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming here. Mine is the slightly easier task, I think, of providing a general overview of the human rights situation in Sudan and some of the violations that are taking place there and our concerns with what may happen, not only in the build-up to the April 2010 elections and after that, but also in the build-up to the 2011 referendum. Human Rights Watch has been working on Sudan since 1998, and we have covered pretty much the whole country, including South Sudan, North Sudan, and what's been happening in Darfur, and we have released scores of reports on the situation in Sudan as a whole. So I'm going to begin by presenting a brief overview of the general situation in the entire country, and then I'll talk very specifically about what's happening in North Sudan, what's happening in Darfur, and what, in our view, is happening in the south of Sudan. Most of the information that's coming out from the north of Sudan and from Darfur is based, because we have been unable to go into these regions, is based on the information that we've been getting, reliable, credible information that we've been getting from our local partners on the ground. In South Sudan, most of the information that I'll present to you this evening is based on the research missions that we have undertaken, including one most recently in October, where we visited Juba and other surrounding areas in the south of Sudan. So, as has been indicated, elections are coming up in Sudan in April 2010. And we are very concerned that violations of civil and political rights by security forces throughout the country are seriously undermining the prospects for free, fair, and credible elections in the country as a whole. The government in Khartoum continues to maintain an atmosphere of fear and repression. In southern Sudan, there is increasing violence, which is heightening the risk of attacks on civilians in the absence of adequate protection from the UN mission, United Nations mission, in South Sudan. We are also worried that the potential for violence along the border and in some states in South Sudan could restrict movement and prevent people from accessing the polls when the elections actually take place. In Darfur, harsh restrictions on speech and assembly persist, and serious abuses against civilians by government soldiers, militias, rebels, and bandits in and around the IDP camps, internally displaced persons camps, are continuing. The poor human rights conditions on the ground are likely to result in the election of an indicted president in Omar al-Bashir. We believe that Omar al-Bashir should be in The Hague, be facing trial before the International Criminal Court, but in the end, it looks likely that he will continue to be president of Sudan, and that's a huge concern for us. Now, in the north, as I said, there's an atmosphere of repression that is prevailing in the capital and in the northern states. We have seen Sudanese authorities targeting Darfuris, suspected rebels, opposition parties, and human rights activists for arbitrary arrests and very lengthy detentions. In addition, the Sudanese authorities continue to stifle speech and freedom of the media through aggressive preprint censorship and by harassing and arresting journalists. Although President al-Bashir officially lifted the preprint censorship in September, journalists continue to self-censor in fear of arrest. They are avoiding topics of a sensitive nature, such as the elections themselves and what is going on in Darfur. The authorities have also placed restrictions on freedom of expression and assembly by violently suppressing peaceful demonstrations and refusing to grant permission for public rallies and other events, despite applications being made. For example, on December the 7th, we had riot police and security forces arresting more than 140 people, including political leaders and journalists, and injuring more than 40 people while dispersing crowds in Khartoum. A week later, riot police and security forces again used excessive force to disperse crowds and made scores of arrests. It was even more interesting when on December 16, the presidential advisor and former head of national security, Salah Ghosh, announced that the government would not allow any public demonstrations, saying conditions were not suitable for this form of expression. The government has also already prevented or banned numerous other public gatherings and events related directly to the elections in numerous places around the country. The harassment, arrests, and detention of activists and election observers in northern states is also another serious concern. We've got numerous examples. For example, in South Darfur, national security forces beat and arrested an election observer and detained him without charge for 25 days. In Khartoum, the capital, armed national security forces assaulted and arrested members of an activist group for distributing flyers, with slogans opposing President Omar al-Bashir. We have seen more of these detentions. In Darfur also, the authorities are continuing to detain 16 leaders from displaced person camps in El Fasher, North Darfur, under emergency laws that grant sweeping powers of detention to state authorities. Police arrested the group in early August while they were investigating a murder. The prosecutor released them for lack of evidence, but the security forces re-detained them and they remain in detention. We have dozens of Darfuri student activists who are also in detention. For example, Abdel Majid Sali, a well-known Darfuri activist who has spoken out about Darfur and international justice and who has been in detention without charge since August. He was released on January 16, but he was held for several months until his release on January 16. As I've said, we've had other human rights activists who speaking out about the elections also being harassed, assaulted, or arbitrarily arrested. For example, four members of the United Popular Front, a student group, which has spoken publicly in support of the ICC arrest warrant against al-Bashir, and who are currently being held in detention. They've been held without charge since April. So that is those are the kind of conditions that we're talking about in the north, which make it increasingly unlikely for there to be free, fair, or credible elections. Now we come to Darfur, which is already a complicated situation and which has not been receiving much attention lately. And it's important for us to note that the security situation in Darfur has not actually improved as much as people would like to believe. Even as the government announced in November that it would dismantle all IDB camps by 2010, serious abuses against civilians by government soldiers, militias, rebels, and bandits in the IDP camps and around the IDP camps continued. In September, we documented cases of civilians fleeing clashes and government bombing in North Darfur and Jebel Mara, a rebel stronghold in central Darfur. So even if the government and the GEM rebels, the Justice Equality Movement rebels, were to sign a ceasefire the next round of talks in October, the situation in Darfur would not improve because there is no genuine inclusive peace process. Meanwhile, the humanitarian expulsions, which took place soon after the arrest warrant against al-Bashir was released, have severely weakened the aid operation, massively reducing our capacity, quality, and humanitarian space. Civilians affected by the conflict in Darfur continue to suffer the consequences of the expulsions, and the NGOs that remain do not have any human rights or protection mandates or programs and advocacy programs actually running in the area. This weakening of the international network, which has been combined with the wholesale closing down of three human rights organizations in Sudan, and the ongoing crackdown on Sudanese human rights activists and journalists, means basically that there's very little information that is actually coming out of Darfur. Despite its promises, the government has also continued to obstruct both aid and the work of the United Nations African Union mission in Darfur. The four NGOs that were allowed to return after U.S. Special Envoy Gratian's agreement with Khartoum are not yet operational, and other NGOs continue to face restrictions. The UNAMID deployment has been hampered by the government's refusal for visas for Westerners and permission for critical equipment. The government also prevents UNAMID patrols and protection of civilians, civilian activists on the ground. Finally, the Sudanese government has failed to take measures to hold perpetrators responsible for the most serious crimes committed in Darfur, or improve the administration of justice to provide accountability for ongoing crimes. The result is an environment of entrenched impunity. In this context of entrenched impunity, the AU High-Level Panel on Darfur released a report in November, which lays out concrete proposals for achieving both justice and peace in the region. The report stresses the need for prosecutions of those responsible for the worst abuses committed in Darfur, including through the creation of hybrid courts. It is our opinion that the AU needs to, which actually backed this this panel report, needs to take appropriate measures to expedite the implementation of the panel's proposals to ensure free and credible justice for serious crimes in Darfur. Notably, the Mbeki panel took no position on the proposed hybrid court's relationship to the International Criminal Court. And so a new hybrid court, in our view, should not be seen as a possible substitute for the ICC's cases for Darfur crimes. We believe that more, not less, justice is needed for the people of Darfur. We have also documented something that's of concern to us, increasing levels of repression of political freedoms in the south of Sudan. And this, as I've said, was based on two missions that we undertook in October to Juba and surrounding areas. Southern Sudan, as many of you may have seen in the reports, has experienced increasing volatility in 2009. I think it was documented that at least 2,000 people had died from inter-ethnic clashes. We have also seen incidents of this type of violence continue into the new year. But not only that, as I've said, we have seen Sudanese authorities arresting, detaining, and mistreating dozens of people for their political opinion in the lead-up to the elections. Dozens of members of the northern ruling NCP and political parties seem to be in alliance with it have been arrested. We have numerous examples in Awil, which is in northern Bahr-el-Ghazal, for example. Authorities arrested the head of the United Democratic Party, alleging that his party was not properly registered. They detained him in a safe house for 2 weeks and then transferred him to military barracks. We also have examples in Juba, in western Bahr-el-Ghazal, in Upper Nile, where we have seen reports of government soldiers arresting 22 members of the SPLM-DC in Renk, detaining them in military barracks, interrogating them, beating them up, and forcing them to sign an agreement to stop their political activities. These members were held for 3 days, and we've also seen party members of this same party being detained in Uyei, Rumbek, and other towns. So there have been numerous incidents of arrests by the security forces and governments of other political parties attempting to campaign or attempting to carry out their political activities in and around South Sudan. The NCP has also reported numerous arrests and detentions in towns across southern Sudan. We're also concerned by restrictions on media freedoms in South Sudan, which seem to reflect similar activities to those carried out by the NCP-led Khartoum government and security organs in the north. For example, government of South Sudan officials physically threatened staff of the radio station of the Catholic Church, Bakita Radio, for their public criticism of government actors. The media in the south have been trying so far without success to push the Legislative Assembly to adopt human rights compliant media laws, but this hasn't been the case. But of greater concern for us, as we've said, are the inter-ethnic clashes that we have seen taking place in 2009 and into 2011. 2011 opened with a recent clash between Nuer and Dinka, which left 139 people dead in Tonj. We also had the shooting of the Minister of Agriculture, Samson Kwaje, who was shot in Wondoruma Payam as he was trying to encourage voter registration. And he was allegedly shot by armed members of the community because he had been trying, against their will, to move their Payam to a neighboring county. So this is there were election also related issues around this this problem. This case and others like it, similar cases which we have documented illustrate that the elections process can spark violence and that conflicts between communities over land and other issues should be addressed before the elections. The government of South Sudan has so far failed to address the root causes of the inter-ethnic clashes, and to the extent that they may be politically manipulated, these clashes could intensify in the lead-up to elections and the southern referendum. So the government of South Sudan authorities have informed us, and we have heard from them during our interviews with them and discussions with them, that they intend to respond to inter-ethnic violence with forced civilian disarmament. We are concerned that if they proceed with this without careful planning, the process could also turn violent and result in human rights violations, which we saw similar to 2006. At the same time, there has been no action by the United Nations mission in Sudan, even though protection of civilians is supposed to be its primary mandate. The government authorities and UNMISS, as it's called, have done little to prevent or prepare for likely security problems. As of December, government authorities were just starting to plan to train extra forces to provide security at polling places. However, and the UN has also been training the Southern Sudan Police Force, but has no plans to deploy its own forces to hotspots during the elections. So as you can see, the situation in Sudan is quite complex. There are various issues at play in the north, in the south, and in Darfur. And we have a number of asks, as is always per usual with our reporting, that we'd like to see happen, even though we are worried about the conditions and we are concerned that they'll be not conducive to free, fair, and credible elections. There are still a few things that can be done, A, in the build-up to these elections, and B, looking towards the referendum in 2011. The first thing is that the National Unity Government should be ensuring that government authorities at all levels respect the rights under the Constitution and international law to freedom of expression, assembly, association, and end the excessive use of force by the police to disperse peaceful demonstrations. Both the national government and the government of South Sudan should be ending arbitrary arrests and detentions of people and their mistreatment. The police should be held accountable. They should also allow for a robust international observer presence with full freedom of movement in all parts of the country. The United Nations mission in Sudan should be increasing its presence and patrolling of volatile areas in the north and the south in line with its mandate to protect civilians, ensuring more temporary protection bases in Darfur, and also ensuring, more protection bases in Darfur. From the U.S. perspective, we see that Sudan is a big and a major African foreign policy issue for them. And we think that the U.S. government and the U.S. can play a key role in pushing the United Nations on civilian protection. It's also important to note that the United Nations mission in Sudan will be renewing its mandate in April of this year. And so there's opportunities there to kind of push for greater, I think, civilian protection in Sudan as a whole, but also mainly in South Sudan. In Darfur, we think that UNAMID is doing an excellent job, despite the government attempts that I've highlighted to obstruct its work and its patrols. But you should also be increasing patrolling in and around the camps. We should be looking from UNAMID for regular reports and transparency on civilian protection and human rights concerns throughout Darfur. And finally, as a final recommendation, we think international donors and stakeholders, such as the U.S. government, the African Union, and the EU, should be urgently deploying election observers in time to effectively monitor pre-election conditions. The AU should promptly deploy a robust election observer team across Sudan, including in Darfur, and ensure that regional standards for observing and reporting on the elections are strictly met. We would also like to see the African Union leaders press the two peacekeeping forces in Sudan to give top priority to what we feel is the most crucial aspect, which is protecting civilians. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kasambala. Our next speaker, the Honorable Ezekiel Lol Gatkaw.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brooks. Maybe next time you can make the podium a little bit taller. I will be very brief also about what is happening in Sudan. You might have realized that I was a bit exhausted. I just came back from Sudan 4 days ago. If you see me dozing, so don't be surprised. I'm still having a jet lag. Sudan is actually a very complex topic when you are talking about Sudan. Of course, I'm a Sudanese. I represent the government of Southern Sudan here, not the government of Sudan. And the SPLM as a party. In the history of Sudan, Sudan has been colonized by many countries. The Turks were there, the Egyptians were there, the United Kingdom, they were there also. But in the last colony, it was a condominium rule, the Anglo-Egyptian rule, were ruling the country from 1899 until its independence in 1956. But before the independence in 1956, the British decided that because they used to govern Sudan in two districts. They had something that they have introduced, a closed districts ordinance governing South as a separate country and also the North as a separate country. So for you to leave from South to the North, definitely you need to have a departure order. And the same to the North. And then when they were preparing for the independence in 1947, they have called a conference in Juba, which is actually the current capital of Southern Sudan, to prepare for the independence, and they have to console the people of Southern Sudan so that the two countries by then can be merged and become an independent country. Before the independence, of course, the Southerners decided that this is not suitable for them. So in 1955, we rebel. Okay, I cannot hear my voice. So I'll try to be a bit louder. In 1955, the people of Southern Sudan decided that they wanted to go to war because the preparation, the independence of the Sudan that was prepared, we were not accepting it. We went to war, and of course, Sudan became independent in 1956. But the war between the North and the South, it started in 1955, and we had an agreement. Of course, it lasted from 1955 until 72, and we had an agreement in 1972 in Addis Ababa. And basically, the war was basically a war of marginalization and of course, underdevelopments in the South. Basically, there's nothing in the South as of now. People are talking about reconstruction. It is basically construction because nothing was built since creation. We had an agreement in 1972, and that agreement was meant to have a relative peace in Sudan from 1972. We continued for another 10 years, and we were supposed to have a referendum in 1982 to decide if Sudan can be, or Southern Sudan can be, a part of Sudan. That agreement did not last. The then president of Sudan, Jafar Nimeiri, decided that this agreement is not a Bible or a Quran. He dishonored it. And then the war started again in 1983. And this is the war that I participated as a young man. In 1985, I joined the rebellion, headed by late leader Dr. John Garang Mabio. And we continued to fight until 2005. And of course, you have heard of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement that was signed in Nairobi. This is another attempt also to see if we can address the problem of Sudan peacefully. In that agreement, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, it was actually meant to address two issues. One of them is to try to transform Sudan into a better Sudan for all of us, because for the Southern Sudanese, Sudan doesn't belong to them. It belongs to the Northern Sudanese, who assumed the responsibility after the British left, and they continued to marginalize the other areas, East, Darfur, and also Southern Sudan. So we are trying to address this issue of Sudan by making unity attractive, the unity of Sudan to be attractive to the marginalized people of Sudan. The second one is to ask the Southern Sudanese in 2011 if this country is, the unity of the country is attractive enough for them to continue to be a part of Sudan, or they can choose independence. We had this agreement from 2005 until now. We are only having 1 year left for the people of Southern Sudan to decide if they are going to be part of Sudan or not. But as it looks now, the unity of Sudan has not been made attractive to the Southern Sudanese. So the possibility of having another country in Sudan in 2011 January is there. But before that, we are going to have election in April this year. I just came back from Juba. The SPLM had a meeting, and we have decided that we are going to contest against President Bashir. We have nominated somebody, a senior member of the SPLM, Yasser Al-Aman. He's going to run against Bashir. Of course, Yasser is from the north, but he has been with us in the south, fighting against the northern Sudanese. So he has been nominated to run against Bashir. But we are having concern, serious concern about election, if it is going to be credible or free and fair. Some people are talking about free and fair election. But somebody was telling me, you don't need to talk about free and fair election. Try to actually say if it is going to be credible enough to for all of the political parties which are running to see or to basically say that this election is credible enough. So there is a possibility this election, because Bashir is worried about himself. He has been indicted, as you are aware of it. So it is a matter of life and death. If I'm Bashir, I would be really worried about my future. Of course, we have been partners for a long time, from 2005 until now, but the partnership between the two is not working. That's why we have decided that the only way to transform Sudan into a better Sudan is to have SPLM governing the country. Of course, this election, he's seeing it to be his last chance to legitimize himself so that the ICC is not going to take him. So he wanted to win this election by all means. So the question is it going to be a free and fair election? People are saying it is not going to be free and fair. And if it is not free and fair, what will happen? That is a possibility, that if people decided that this election has been rigged by Bashir, then they can, you know, create chaos or uprising in the country will happen. And then also the civil war can reignite it again. Of course, after the election in January 9th, 2011, we are going to have a referendum. And in this referendum, if you assess the thinking of the southern Sudanese now, 98% of them, they will vote for separation, because they are fed up with the north. They have been cheated. Even in the agreement, 90% of the oil that is being exported to China and also to Malaysia is from the south. And then we are dividing the resources that are being exploited in the south. In the oil, the north is getting 50% of the oil revenues that are generated in the south, and we are getting 50%. Still, we are being cheated also from our own resources that we are dividing with the north. Then if it is the case that Southern Sudan will be an independent state in 2011, questions are coming up. Is it going to be a peaceful divorce between the two entities, the north and the south? For Northern Sudanese, of course, they are desperate to continue to have access to resources of the south. Even though we have tried for the last 4 years, 5 years, to share resources, they wanted to continue to share the resources, even after 2011. So the U.S. government and many people who have been committed to bringing peace to Sudan, they are actually asking the two parties, it is very important for you to decide, you know, to start discussing the post-2011 arrangement, how you can continue to share the resources, especially the issue of oil and the issue of the assets and the debts, because now Sudan is owing the World Bank and the IMF $36 billion. Of course, to us Southern Sudanese, these are the debts that has been incurred by the North buying guns and weapons to kill us. So why do we have to share the responsibility of taking the part of these debts? So, and also the issue of nationalities. If the two entities are divorcing, that is a possibility that there are northern Sudanese that are in the south and southern Sudanese in the north. How are you going to have this exchange of citizens peacefully without just forcing them out of the country? Also, the grazing rights for the Arab tribes that are in the border areas. Will they continue to access the south so that their cattle can have water and graze in the south? These are the things that people are starting to think of how we can resolve them. Because people are saying that if these are not resolved, then there is a possibility of returning to war. And maybe for some of you who have been following Sudan very closely, there are some firing statements that are coming from the north saying that this referendum is actually a provocation and they are going to respond forcefully unless there is an agreement on the post-2011 arrangement. Some issues also are coming up. The issue of viability of Southern Sudan after 2011. If we are going to have a state, is it going to be a viable state after 2011? And my sister was talking about the issue of security in the south and the capacity. I'm standing in front of you here. I never worked in the government before. I don't even know how to run an embassy. But I happens to be there, so what do I do? Even when I joined the rebellion in 1985, I didn't go to school. I struggled to educate myself. So our capacity is lacking, and that's why we are appealing to the world, especially the U.S. and other countries, to help in building our capacity so that we can manage the affairs of the South. We have been trying our best from 2005 until now, trying to, you know, manage our resources, providing governance, because we have to administer the South for the last 5 years. So our capacity is lacking. That's why you have been seeing us having difficulties in controlling some of the violences that are happening in the South. Even though it is being encouraged by the North, the arms are coming from the North, because the strategy of the North now, or the National Congress Party, I don't want to generalize it. It is not everybody in the North which is actually doing this. It is the National Congress Party. They are trying to use the weaknesses of the South, you know, raiding cattle and having community violence, you know, by providing guns to the Southern Sudanese communities so that they can fight themselves and make it very difficult for the SPLM to govern the South. And also to make it look like the Southern Sudanese cannot govern themselves. And then there is no way to allow them to go and have an independent state, so they need to continue to be part of the North. This is another tactics that they are using Janjaweed in Darfur, and they have used Murhaleen, or Popular Defense Force, in the South for many years. So that's what they are using. But of course, we are responding by disarming the communities and providing SPLA forces, because the police is very weak in the South. They cannot really protect communities. So we are using SPLA to disarm and provide security. So yes, we are going to be a viable state. We are governing ourselves in 2011, but we need our capacity to be built so that we can do more after 2011. We have only 11 months left. So this year is the only last year that we are going to have for the comprehensive peace agreement to be realized. In 2011, Sudan will witness a different story altogether. It is going to be either one country or possibility of having two countries living side by side in peace is going to happen in 2011. And I'm just asking people like you and other friends in the world to help us in having a peaceful divorce in 2011. I just wanted to end here, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gothkopf. And now we'll hear from our third speaker, Roger Winter.
Well, I'm going to more or less pick up where Ezekiel ended up a little bit, because I've been asked to talk about the United States and our role with respect to some of this. We want to make sure we leave enough time for you to ask questions, so I'm going to try to cut this shorter than I would have normally. If you followed Ezekiel's log of dates, what it means is that South Sudan has been at war for 75% of the time that Sudan has been a state, an independent state, when the British left. 75% of the time the South has been at war. So the feelings are very clear when he said that he used the figure of a very high percentage of people in the South who will vote for separation if there is a free and fair election. That's not a pipe dream. That's a documented number. We, the United States, when I was at USAID, we funded the National Democratic Institute, which is an arm of the Democratic Party. We did the same thing with the International Republican Group. Did focus studies. It started in 2005. They're still done on a regular basis now. And those focus studies from all over the South and the so-called three areas indicate that 98% of the people of the South, if given a free and fair opportunity to vote, will vote for separation from Khartoum. Okay. That's the history of the independent state, makes that the natural, unfortunately, solution. The United States, when I say the United States, I'm really talking now about the people, less the government right now. People in this country weren't very interested in Sudan and what was going on in Sudan for most of its history. What began to develop as a constituency in the United States, a popular constituency in the United States, started to really happen, from my perspective, in the latter half of the 1980s. The latter half of the 1980s, journalists from the Atlanta Constitution and, you know, lots of others started showing up in South Sudan, which was at war at the time. Congressman Frank Wolf of Virginia and Congressman Mickey Leland of Mississippi, who then died in an air crash over there going to see Sudanese refugees in Ethiopia, and so forth. A constituency started to develop. It was a bipartisan constituency. And the constituency for Sudan today remains a bipartisan constituency. What this ultimately led to was the United States in 2001, I lost the century, decided that the U.S. was going to actually try to bring about a peace in the South. Okay? Didn't have a lot of experience in Sudan because our embassy had been closed for years because there was violence against our embassy. And it had been shut down. In any event, I won't go through the details of it, but the leadership then provided, working with the government of Kenya and the regional states, as well as the Dutch and the Norwegians and the British, embarked on what became a four-year negotiation to produce what is called the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. It didn't happen like this. It took 4 years of leading negotiations and forcing the parties together and staying up all night just talking through issues with them and so forth. That, if you haven't looked at the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, that's what it's called. You ought to take a look. It's a pretty amazing document in some ways. And Ezekiel mentioned Dr. John Garang before. He and the current vice president of the government in Khartoum, Ali Osman Taha, used to spend nights together, just the two of them in a room, talking, and working their way through this thing. But it wouldn't have happened without the United States. So the United States is the one that has led the production of the peace agreement that now exists, that does the kinds of things that Brother Ezekiel was just talking about a few moments ago. The referendum is the holy grail. If you talk to Southern Sudanese today, to be honest with you, they're not all that interested in the elections, because they do believe that elections will serve the purpose. They won't really be free and fair. They will serve the purpose of legitimizing President Bashir as the president of the country. And that's going to happen by hook or by crook. That's a foregone conclusion. So they're really focused on this referendum, which is now something like 11 months and 2 weeks away, right? Now, because this is sort of the end game in this whole CPA peace agreement package, we're starting to get now. It's becoming real. It's not 5 years down the road or 6 years or something like that. It's now less than a year down the road. And what we're hearing a lot about is something that Ezekiel mentioned a moment ago, but I want to talk a little bit more about, is this idea of, does the secession of South Sudan, if that's what happens, does that mean that we are essentially creating a failed state? All right. And that's a serious issue. I view it differently than most of my colleagues, however. Okay. Most of the time, I think we look at failed states as unable to really do the jots and tittles of governance efficiently and effectively, okay? And I would submit that what's more important is the soul of what people are trying to deliver to the people for whom they govern. All right, and I want to talk about that for a moment. The National Congress Party, that is the party in charge in Khartoum, is a party that came to power by coup on June the 30th of 1989. When it did that coup, it did it to abort peace. Right? There was a peace agreement that was involving. The Democratic Unionist Party had signed an agreement with the SPLM. The UN had been allowed to come in because there was a movement toward peace, and set up something called Operation Lifeline Sudan that really gave the UN the power to do massive humanitarian assistance throughout the South and the other areas that were affected. What it meant was that the other major party, the so-called Umma Party, was moving toward a peace agreement, all right? And so this National Islamic Front, now called the National Congress Party, did their coup. Since then, during their custody of governance, they are responsible for somewhere in the neighborhood of 2.5 million deaths. Now, 2.5 million is a holocaustic number. I mean, this is not a little violence here and there. This is a big number, and it is very clearly documented. Okay? The number in the South, about 2.5 million people during the term of this government in Khartoum. This is the same government that's also done Darfur, as you know. And there are significant numbers of deaths there also. Now, All right? So we have a government that came in power to abort a peace that was coming down the pike. They did their coup, and in governing, as it were, they're responsible for at least 2.5 million deaths. If you had ever been in South Sudan, as I was, because I'm regularly there even today, every other month, and have been going there since 1981, I can tell you that South Sudan was the most destroyed place in the entire world. You wouldn't believe it, okay, if you were there. All right, so now what I'm trying to get at is, all right, who is the failed state in this discussion we're having right now? Now, in the case of the South, we have a government that is 60 months old. You got a 5-year-old child or grandchild? Okay. We have a government that came into being 60 months ago. That's 5 years. Okay. They came to power at a time where the population was the largest amount of displaced people, both inside the country and outside as refugees, than any place in the world. The most destroyed landscape, never having opportunities for education or any of the usual things because they were dispersed all over the globe and still are to a very significant portion of them. All right. In the case of Khartoum, we have a government in power that shows no interest in developing the marginalized populations. And I'm not just talking about the South, okay, but no interest there, okay? No interest in developing the marginalized population in Darfur. No interest in developing the marginalized population in the East, which is Beja, okay, or in the north of Sudan. All right, so what I'm trying to get at is this. You are going to hear, if you follow the issues of Sudan, and I really hope you will, because what we need is an informed and active constituency on Darfur and on the issues of the South, on Sudan generally, over the next period especially, because it's going to be a very difficult time. And when you hear people talk about this referendum that the people of the South are so interested in, just keep in mind where that sentiment that those people have is coming from. And when people say it will be a failed state, look behind the surface issues, okay? The government of South Sudan is a weak government, okay? There's no question about it, okay? It has a corruption problem. There's no question about it, okay? There is communal violence that they haven't got a handle on at this point. Yes, some of it is stimulated by Khartoum, okay? But they haven't handled it yet. But all of those kind of problems are addressable because that is a government, and the SPLM is a party, that wants democratic governance and that wants to develop the populations for which they're responsible. You don't have any such soul like that in Khartoum. All right? So to me, I would say, where really is the merit, the American interest? Is it that we do everything according to whatever a proper system should be on day one? No, we all want them to get into that proper system, no question about it. But the question is, I would say, from the point of view of the American people, what we should want is somebody in charge in South Sudan that wants to develop the population and wants to have democratic governance, all right? And In that, the government of South Sudan and the SPLM have it all over whatever the current government structure is in Khartoum. So let me just suggest that what we have done recently, okay, is we have sort of destabilized the South. The South has come, at least, especially since the constituency that developed in the U.S. in the 80s, to believe that somehow we had their back. And they're not so sure anymore. And that can lead to dangerous actions and desperate actions and things like that. And what I would argue as an American is that the American population should want to be maximally supportive of the party that has the right to a referendum, a free and fair choice, by negotiation, with everybody agreeing to it, and that has the primary interest in our values, too, of developing the population of the South and of having a democratic system of government. Thanks.
Well, thank you to our three panelists. Now we're going to open it up to questions, and it is now 7 o'clock. We're going to go to 7:15 because we had three panelists and would like to entertain some of the questions, if that's okay. So I'm going to start with, I'm going to take two questions and bring them together because there's some similarity in them. One of them is, and I'm going to ask each of you to speak briefly to these questions. Why has the United Nations and the world community not stepped in to stop the genocide, in your opinion? And the other piece of the question is, why do you think that what's happening in the Sudan, particularly in the south and in Darfur, hasn't arisen the same kind of passion and anger that the genocide in the Israeli-Palestine matter has wrought? We'll start with you, Tzeke, on those two.
Yeah, why is the UN and world community not stepping in to stop the genocide? Interestingly enough, I think the international community has stepped in, finally. The arrest warrant that was issued against Omar al-Bashir in March last year was for war crimes and crimes against humanity in Darfur. And that is where those are the crimes that were taking place in Darfur at that time, and that I think that basically covers it. So very briefly, I think, yes, the international community has finally stepped in. This came from the United Nations Security Council, which is the one which said that the ICC should go ahead with an investigation into what had been taking place in Darfur. And when the ICC carried out its investigations, it concluded that there should be an arrest warrant issued against al-Bashir and also others, including the leader of the rebel movement, the Janjaweed rebel movement as well. So this is why al-Bashir can't travel to many countries around the world at the moment, especially those that are state parties to the ICC. I'll leave the other question.
Okay.
In the interest of time.
I never understand how the so-called international community works. But in the case of China and the case of Sudan, China is a major factor here. So are others, but China, because it's the biggest exploiter of oil in Sudan. It has all its contracts with Khartoum, and it's one of the permanent five in the Security Council. And that carries a lot of weight as a package. And it is in their interest, they think, I guess, to have that protective influence with respect to the country of Sudan. I guess there are probably other things, but that was the first thing that occurred to me when I heard the question.
So, to the three of you, is it necessary, do you think, to have support from the African Union leadership to successfully prosecute President Bashir in the International Court?
Yes, indeed. And I think one of the things that we've been doing at Human Rights Watch is advocating with the African Union, because I don't know if many of you know, when this arrest warrant was issued against Omar al-Bashir initially, many African states complained that it would jeopardize the peace in South Sudan, or also what was happening in Darfur. And they requested that the United Nations Security Council should defer the arrest warrant for a period of 1 year. When the UN Security Council decided not to do so, many African states, including those that are state parties to the International Criminal Court, were quite upset and initially came out with a resolution. The AU came out with a resolution at its annual summit last year that it would not cooperate with the arrest of al-Bashir. Fortunately for us, with advocacy from local NGOs, ourselves and other international organizations, many member states of the ICC from Africa have kind of withdrawn from this and have reinstated their obligations under the ICC to arrest al-Bashir if he was to step in any of their countries. So like I've said, I think conditions for al-Bashir right now have pretty much narrowed down to a few countries which he can visit that are not state parties to the ICC on the continent, and that's a very positive move. So we're hoping that the African Union will be pushing at some point for the arrest of al-Bashir as a whole, as an entity. But at the moment, we've got 30 member states of the ICC all saying, most of them saying that, you know, they are obliged to arrest al-Bashir if he steps in their countries.
I would say God bless Botswana.
Yes, Botswana definitely led the move and the drive towards pushing the other African states, definitely. Yeah, they've played a very positive role. We're still having problems around the ICC, but, you know, we remain hopeful that, you know, hopefully he will be arrested at some point.
To my sister and also Uncle Roger. I think African head of states are really, because all of them are indictable, they are actually afraid that if they are going to allow Bashir to be indicted and arrested and taken to the ICC, this is the road to all of them. This is the road that they will go through. And that's why you see them so opposed to the arrest of Bashir. And they are not going to cooperate, even though they are saying that if he's going to step into our country and we will arrest him, I don't think this is the case. They might be saying it, but they are not committed to it. It seems like, I don't know what Bashir is using. He might be using money to just bully them. Because even now he's allowed to come to the AU summits, and all of them, they are there, they are not saying anything. So I don't think they are ready to arrest him, because they are also afraid for their own fate also.
So here's a question also related to the President Bashir, and that is, with the resources and just the whole nature of this the man who's leading out of Khartoum, can the South really secede? Can it, after the referendum, if it's successful, will he allow for the divorce? Can he be trusted? And we'll start with you on that one, Ezekiel.
Yes. Bashir is not ready for the South to secede. And not only Bashir, all Northern Sudanese, be it Sadiq al-Mahdi and Morgane and all of them, they are not ready for the South to secede. For simple reason. All the resources that are being generated in Sudan are from the South. You know, talking of the water, the Nile water, Egypt is also affected in this. They are so concerned about the secession of the South. The oil that I was telling you, 90% of it is from the South. The agricultural land basically is from the South. Basically, all the resources that are being exploited in Sudan are from the South. So they would try their best not to allow the South to go. But do they have option? Because for us, and Uncle Roger was saying it clearly, this is a red line. We can compromise election, but referendum we will not. If you extended it for 1 day, this is actually a declaration of war on the South, and we will go and fight for it, because this is the only thing that we have. So they will not allow us to go, but if they have no option at all, then what they will do is to use what I was telling you before, post-2011 arrangement. So can we continue to share your oil? And then can we have also access to water? And how about other resources? So we somehow we have to have an agreement. And then in that, then they will allow us to go. It's basically buying our independence, using our resources.
If I can, let me just sort of add to that. Khartoum has a style of saying no by not saying no. Okay, what they do is they stall. Okay, they stall on something that's in the, like, for example, the law on the referendum under the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was supposed to have been enacted by January of 2008. Okay? It didn't happen. Okay? Now, it just happened. The issue was forced about 2 months ago, finally. Okay? But they stall, and they constantly do that. And what happens is then even the outsiders begin to say, well, there's not enough time to do this. And this is how they get around things. There's actually two referendums that are supposed to happen. One is the one that we've been talking about that involves all of the South. But there's also a piece of the South that back in 1905 was moved to the North for the British convenience for administration. So you have a population of Southerners who were moved into the North, okay, to a different side of the river, okay? So that is now in the North. It is also a major oil field, and under the CPA, it gets its own referendum to decide if it's going to remain in the North or move to the South. Now, this is too complicated for me to explain the details in the time we have. Let me just say that Bashir refused to implement that part of the CPA for the first 3 years at all, okay? In May of 2008, his soldiers went in and burned the entire place out. I was there, okay, as that happened, okay? Burned the whole place out. His soldiers then that did that, today, the officers all got promoted. It's the 31st Sudan Armed Forces Brigade. Okay, the officers got promotions. Right now, they're about 6 miles away from the place they burned down. Okay, they've never been punished for it. In fact, got rewarded for it. Now, the boundary of Abyei has never been demarcated. So the failure to do that as required earlier on meant that the case ultimately went to what's called the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague. Last July, the Permanent Court of Arbitration made its decision on what the boundaries of Abyei should be. All right? And Khartoum came out of that pretty well. They came out better than anybody thought they might have come out of that. However, today, as of now, they're still not letting that border be demarcated, all right? The border of Abyei. You go there, you'll find the same 31st Brigade is up there, and another brigade also, and they're intimidating the engineers that are trying to put the markings that you put in the ground. How are you going to have a referendum there on who votes, I mean, if you can't tell where the border is? Well, now here's the larger problem. There's no marking of the border between North and South. Okay. Yes, some people know about it, and there may be a marker here or a marker there, but we're talking about a border that hasn't been carefully demarcated. So how do you have elections when you don't have boundaries? How do you figure out where the precincts are, you know, and everything? You don't have a beginning boundary to start with. Okay, so that border... Ask Mr. Bashir, why has that border never been demarcated? And I bet you it has something to do with that referendum.
So Last couple of questions, one to you, Tshiseke, and then the last one's going to be to you, Ezekiel. And for you, the question is, yesterday the press reported on new findings which the state the majority of deaths in Darfur were caused by disease rather than violent death from conflict. What's your reaction to this new report? Are you aware of it? And what do you think?
I'm not aware of the report, but I mean, our own findings showed that it was not just disease, although quite a significant number of deaths in the camps and in Darfur have occurred because of disease, because of a lack of food, but also because of violent death. So it's a combination of all three, you know, lack of food, disease, and violent death.
And Ezekiel, the last question. And let me make an observation. You said that you were self-taught and didn't quite know how to run an embassy. I can speak to your being very well educated. So if you're self-taught, wow. And as a diplomat, I don't know that you have many peers. So my question to you, sir, is, what is it that gives you hope and optimism as you look at the upcoming referendum and just the future in general?
thank you. And thank you for your compliment. But it is actually the reality. I didn't know how to read and write until 1989, actually. When I went to the bush in 1985, I didn't know how to read and write. What is actually giving me hope? Just wanted to say one thing about the people of the United States of America. Uncle Roger was saying it seriously, that if it is not because of the United States of America and the people of the United States of America, this comprehensive peace agreement would have not been realized. President Bush, even though he's having his own issues here in the U.S., he's very popular in Southern Sudan, very popular in Southern Sudan, because he made it an issue when he came to power in 2001 that there has to be peace in Southern Sudan. The churches, people like Franklin Grime and many others, seriously mobilized, and John Danforth was appointed as a special envoy. And Bush was pushing seriously for the agreement to be signed. And he had a nickname when he was in the White House. I met him more than five times in the White House. He had a nickname because every morning he would ask, how is Sudan? What is happening in Sudan? So he had a nickname, and they call him Desk Officer for Sudan. So the commitment and the support that we received from the people of the United States of America, the churches, and the leadership of the U.S. at that time is what is actually giving me hope that this momentum is going to be continued. Also, the Obama administration also is leading in this. Susan Rice, who is a dear friend of mine, very close friend of mine, she's really, really on top of this also. Almost every day she would want to know from me what is happening in Sudan, because she has been involved in this for many years with Uncle Roger, and I am sure this will be the case. In 2011, the U.S. Will support the outcome of the referendum, and the choice of the people must be respected, and this is what is giving me hope. And finally, I just wanted to thank you very much for inviting me here. And I'm so happy that there are people who are also concerned about other people in the world. We are also the same. We are God's children, regardless of where we are or our colors. We are the same. And I think if any human being is suffering in Sudan or in Somalia or in Darfur or any place in the world, it is also the same thing, like if you are suffering here. So let us continue to support one another. Thank you.
That concludes our program for this evening. On behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California and our co-sponsors, please join me in again thanking our speakers for sharing their experience, their insights, their inspiration. Many thanks to the audience for your terrific questions. Again, thank you, folks, for coming.